across as your constituent, and if your constituent is going to put dirty grit all over Anchorage's nice clean snow, would you give us a report, please, on Augustine?
I think your husband may be somewhat in error, but at the expense of that. No, I called the local radio station, and it's the first chance I had to ever call them, because they're always calling me, but... what it is, at 6:30 this morning, I guess the top of
excuse me, can we have quiet in the room, please?
Great. Last time I got this much.
The top of the mountain did blow somewhat this morning. They saw it in Homer. About 6:40, the cloud came over Soldotna and is heading your way, or is heading towards Anchorage. And I guess now they have the smell of sulfur in the Soldotna area. And I guess the cloud is such that your cars, of course, you have to use a windshield wiper at this point because they're coated with the dust. But they still feel that it's not as bad as the one we had in 1976. At this point, the pilots, Anchorage Airport is still open, and the pilots have been told just not to fly into the cloud. So I don't think it's all that serious. But at least it does one thing. I have to mention two areas. Clam Gulch, which is very famous for clamming, and also Coho Loop area are getting it fairly heavily. And if you may recall, the Coho Loop is a road that needs paved by the state. So with this stuff on it, we may have to get in with a grader and at least change it around a little bit so that the contamination isn't there. But it's not all that bad yet.
Is it still bubbling?
There's still smoke coming out. But it's a defined cloud, they say. You can really see the cloud that's heading up your way, which would be neat to see. Maybe we ought to adjourn and
I hope over. It bypasses Anchorage and lands on the Mat-Su Valley. Oh,
that'd be good for me. They also say it's good for soil if you're going to grow potatoes.
Well, that's right. Yeah,
makes,
I think the valley needs that.
Great grinding compound.
As far as the Mat-Su Valley goes, it looks to me like we will be building, thanks to a number of organizations, we'll be building those 500-foot smokestacks to repay you for any overpass of Anchorage with this soot and dust and acid rain.
Well,
you'll get it all from our coal plants.
Now, remember, this is Senator Fisher's constituent, not Anchorage's. And maybe it even belongs to Senator Sackett.
I think the mountain belongs
we'll
to...
We'll send a little as far as Homer before
who
we're through.
Who does the mountain belong to?
I would guess Senator Zaroff, doesn't it? Senator Sackett?
Sackett's right over there, too.
Yeah.
No, we don't
know. It's below Tyonic, you're right. It's not in Sackett's district.
Do you have Iliamna?
The mountain belongs to the gods. Obviously, it's gone.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll get some emergency disaster monies. Who knows?
Okay. Thank you, Senator Fisher, for that update report. I was looking forward to nice, beautiful white snow, and now I guess
I will give you a noon report, too.
Don't help melt it off.
Thank you very much. Let's go on to House Bill 252. The attorneys and staff did what the committee recommended, which was put together the features of House Bill 252 with Senate Bill 121, with the different amendments that the various committee members around this table asked for. You also have, which I think is very good work, an analysis by section of the various fiscal implications of each section of the bill, and that looks like this, and it's in your packet. So there is a net savings of this bill of approximately $1.1 million with the various features. The top portion is the expenses, the bottom part are the features that save, and there is a savings on the bill. Representative Miller, the prime sponsor of the bill, has looked it over. He didn't feel it necessary to testify this morning. He's relatively pleased. In fact, he's totally pleased with the bill, but not having given it a close examination, he didn't want to give it an A-plus yet. You do have your sectional analysis. We have representatives from the Division of Retirement, Legal Services, and the Fiscal Analyst, all who worked on the bill, here to testify before the committee if you so desire. Are there any questions on the bill? Senator Curtula.
Section 18 has always been of interest to me.
Okay, Mr. Humphreys, Mr. Coughlin, would you come forward, please, sirs?
Thank you.
Do you have your sectional?
Yes, I have the sectional, so it led me directly to it while I was going over.
Okay, all right. I would like to compliment you, Mr. Humphreys, and your staff, as well as Teresa Kramer and Jim Slocum, for the work that you folks put in on this, and the backup, and the way, the ease in which we can read this. And it makes our job a lot easier with some advanced work that you folks put into it, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Section 18, sir.
Yeah. I have one other section besides that one there. What is the cost of that, and what does that section mean?
Section 18 is...
right here.
Right.
Look on your right.
Oh.
It's got...
Do I have a...
section. Go ahead, Mr. Humphrey.
Thank you.
Section 18.
Yes, Senator Kula, I think the chair has pointed it out. It's we've estimated that military service credit section to be $70,800. I mean, yeah.
Yes, sir.
This is the one that says former CIA employees, merchant marine during World War II, service that may be claimed as military service.
Yes.
What we're doing now is we're providing for the military buy-in if they work for the state in another job, but we haven't provided for these fringe paramilitary or near-military types. Is that right?
That is correct. Our only concern about this is it's not the fiscal impact of this so much as we're a little concerned about other non-military types that might make a case for...
It's going the opposite of what I think we should do. I think we should be not allowing buy-ins anymore, because when we were paying relatively modest salaries, we provided for retirement buy-ins to attract people into the various professions, teaching and so on. I think that must stop, or the actuarial soundness of the existing fund will be out of shape radically before long. It already is in PERS. Military service credit, you're projecting only $70,800 cost. Is that annual? Is that now? What is this?
That is FY87, Senator, and then it would be...
It will escalate?
Increasing with payroll.
What would you guess from other buy-ins? What was the history of other buy-ins?
Well...
Double, triple, geometric, what?
Well, the total... if you wanted to cost it just as a lump sum... I'd say it would probably be, if you wanted just a $1 one-time payment figure, it would probably be about 10 or 11 times that amount. If you wanted to just pay it off all at once, it would probably be in the vicinity of $700,000 or $800,000. And as far as the history of buy-ins, the history, I think the track record is pretty clear that, when you get a little crack, such as in 360,
yes.
I mean AS3935 360, that if you get one type of buy-in, they tend to multiply. And that's my only concern about this one, is that there are a lot of other non-military types of service that have been proposed in the past. There's Peace Corps, there's VISTA volunteers, and every step in that direction kind of suggests another. So that's our concern with it, more than the absolute cost in this context.
I have one other question. Thank you, Senator Fakes. Sections 8 and 9 allow survivors' benefits to be paid to a spouse of a justice or judge, regardless of whether the spouse remarries. Right now, they're the only payable if the spouse does not remarry. That's
yes.
Sections 8 and 9.
Yes, sir.
And what is the projected cost of that? I don't see it readily here.
We have not assigned any cost to that provision. I'm not certain that is ever come up, and if it did, it might be addressed simply by the person not marrying.
Is a one-year, a marriage lasting 1 year, is that pretty standard throughout the retirement beneficiaries, right?
Yes.
If you're married for a year and the person passes on, that's the beneficiary of the retirement. Is that pretty standard then? That
agrees with the public employee system, which is the
yes,
reason this was changed to agree with that.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Senator Fisher, you just sent me a note. Did you request this from staff earlier,
that's,
sir?
That's what I'm not quite sure whether I was going to do it here as an amendment. Let me ask, maybe it's already incorporated in the bill. You see it. I'm concerned about a peace officer or fireman who was employed by a municipality who is a vested member. Is he eligible to receive credited service for employment before January 1, 1976 as a police officer in a municipality? It's in the system now. There are some folks that have been vested in everything. I think we missed them, or it was missed prior to I got here through the prior.
I'm not sure. Yeah, do you know, John?
John.
Yeah.
But that's a question of a deadline. So I think the answer is no, right? They're not eligible unless we put in something to alter a deadline.
If we were to do that to alter the deadline, do you see any negative impact at all if it was actuarially...
What is going on?
Well, yeah, anytime you open up a deadline that's closed, presumably there's someone on the other side that will get in that wouldn't otherwise, which is, of course, the reason for doing it. It depends, and I don't know how many people are out there. I know that Senator Eliason, for example, has one provision here that was relaxing a deadline, and the best that we could tell we felt like there were only, I think, I forget, two or three people out there that were going to be affected by it, and so we projected a cost of $4,500. And I can't say off the top of my head what it would be in the case that you're talking about, but we'd be happy to try to work something out.
Madam Chair, if we could, after, if we could just hold the bill until we can see if we can work this thing out by Tuesday.
Absolutely. But Tuesday, final, okay, because we've had it for a month, and I'm concerned that we keep promising people this thing's going to come out of committee, and we keep adding to it. It's becoming a real Christmas tree. So if you could work that out by Tuesday, sir, and have a new CS before the committee incorporating that. Is there any other questions on any other sections of this bill? Senator Catula.
It's not a question of section. It's the possibility of adding some. How would the chair look to adding two or three prohibitions of buyback as the audit committee has in this legislation?
I would like the senator to work with the prime sponsor on that, as we've been working on all of these sections, and see how the prime sponsor feels about that. As at this point in time, we have a better than 70% chance that the House will just concur in the Senate amendments. But if we start making prohibitions in there, we're going to throw it into conference, and that's okay. I mean, that's the process. But I would ask you to please ask me.
I will. I'll talk to Mike about it.
Okay. Any other questions on this bill? Senator Ferguson, are all your amendments okay?
Yes.
Okay. Because Senator Fisher needs to look at adding one more section, I guess there's no reason to adopt this particular CS. Mr. Humphreys, again, I thank you. We will do our darndest to get this thing out on Tuesday.
Thank you, Madam.
All right, thank you. Lay that bill aside for right now. Senate Bill 338. Senate Bill 338 is an act making, amending, and repealing appropriations for the Alaska Power Authority for Rail Belt Energy Development, Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project, and the Power Cost Equalization Fund. It's an appropriation bill. It's based on the circumstances of the court case when the judge said that the appropriation bill last year was inappropriate. We would like to take testimony this morning, not pass the bill out of committee until next Tuesday. There are concerns by several of the members that we want to protect this money a little bit more than it is currently protected in this bill. So we'll take testimony this morning, and any of you that have questions that need to be asked for next Tuesday. Senator Halford, this bill is assigned to you, sir. Do you have any other preliminary remarks on it?
No. The thing that I discussed with several people was the possibility of the House approach, which created a fund within the general fund. But I felt that that was dependent on the passage of other legislation and would probably not be as straightforward a way to maintain our commitment to rail belt energy as passing this legislation with a letter of intent that specifically dealt with any amounts to be spent or prohibiting the expenditure of money.
I definitely think we need a prohibition clause in here of some sort, and I think that's one of the questions Senator Catula and I were talking about earlier. I would also like to see some of the utilities involved in a public discussion on the various alternatives and use of the money, too. So I'm looking at ways of incorporating a committee at no bureaucracy, no expense, no per diem, but just a public forum to get some of that information across. Mm-hmm. Senator Catula?
I think that public committee, if we continue the Alaska Power Authority, I think the law needs to be changed again. Jay Hammond changed at the end of his administration. But I think you need to change from four commissioners. Why even have a public authority? You know, just have it a subdivision of the state governor's office if we're going to pack it the way we packed it. I just am totally disgusted with that group right now.
Well, I am too, sir. Okay, with that positive note, let's call Ken Johnson from the Alaska Rural Electric Co-op Corporation. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'd like to thank the chairman for the opportunity to testify on this legislation before the Finance Committee this morning.
Excuse me, Ken, for the record.
Certainly. Ken Johnson from the Alaska Rural Electric Cooperative Association. And we have 15 electric cooperative members in our group, four of which serve almost all of the people in the Rail Belt area as far as electric utilities go. The appropriation of $200 million, Senate Bill 338 would take care of that. It's a very important appropriation to the cooperative utilities in the Rail Belt area. We've expressed to the legislature in years past that if we're going to develop the state and the utilities in unison, develop a project or a number of projects which will meet the future energy needs of the Rail Belt area, that we need state assistance in doing so. And the $200 million, which this bill would appropriate, would go a long ways in doing that, in addition to the $100 million appropriation, which, again, is affirmed in this legislation, although some of it has been spent on other activities. There is a very substantial amount of that money which remains in the Power Development Fund. Addressing just briefly the different ideas that have been thrown about for saving and protecting the money, the utilities do not specifically agree or disagree with any of the alternatives that have been brought forth, but we certainly applaud the legislature for saving the money, and we certainly feel like it should be protected. And until a decision is made on how that money should be used, and then we should come back before the legislature for approval at that time. So we do hope that the legislature will take into account the need to protect that money as you pass this legislation along. Which brings me to the final point that I'd like to make is, how do we spend the money? In light of decisions that have been made in recent days, we're not exactly sure how we're going to use this money in the future, or what the source of future power development, energy development will be in the Rail Belt area. We really feel that we need to work in unison to determine this. The utilities, the legislature, the administration, the power authority need to have a working group to determine what the best alternatives are. I think that the projects that the state has gone through with in recent years have brought the utilities together more, to be able to work together among themselves for the first time and working out agreements for, say, the Rail Belt intertie. And now we're prepared to sit down with members of the legislature and with the APA and other interested groups to determine what the best source of energy development is for the Rail Belt, so that when that decision is made, that group will be solid and that we will go forth together in getting that project or those projects built. Thank you.
Was it my understanding that you said that you would propose legislative approval prior to spending any of the money? Did I hear you say that?
We certainly think that the legislature should be involved in determining how that money should be spent, and would certainly have no problem in coming back to the legislature for approval for spending the money.
Thank you, Ken. Senator Couture?
How do you anticipate being involved in the decision-making? How do you intend to go about it?
Well,
you must have some general thoughts. AREKA is one of the oldest organizations that has promoted legislation to support energy development in the state. And it's a distinguished group of people that are worried about the future of energy. But you must have some thought then, maybe it's more on top of your head, about how you imagine your group to go about coming up with a plan and recommendations that for the expenditure of this and other funds that may accompany it from time to time.
Senator, I believe that what we need is a formal working group which would consist of either managers or some members of the Rail Belt utilities, not only the cooperative utilities, but the municipal utilities that serve the area as well. People who have technical expertise, who are also in management positions, who are well aware of the alternatives and their ramifications. As well, we need the legislature needs to be involved in that working group. We have to have our legislature abreast of the developments and decisions that are being made. We need the administration through the APA to be involved. Their resources are are vital to making a determination as to what power development should be. They have tremendous resources at hand and will continue to develop those in light of recent decisions as to what the best directions for us to go are. So we need that, and as well, we need to keep the public involved. And so we need a formal working group that will bring all these entities together to determine what the best source of power generation in the future for the Rail Belt is.
Do they need to be established legislatively? Does this working group, in order to have credibility, strength, does it need to have a legislative fiat and directive? Or will the rural electrics, municipalities, and so on get together and give, will the public give it sufficient credibility? Will the public give their decisions sufficient credibility to justify all the work and effort that's got to go into making these decisions now?
Well, I certainly think that formal approval or enactment by the legislature would lend more credibility to the working group, and it would also provide for legislative participation, which I still think is a very, very key part to successful development.
Would your organization, as quickly as possible, get us a letter of endorsement of the statement that you just made?
I certainly would be glad to do that.
I'd sure like to see our two finance chairmen, myself, and the members of this committee receive that, because I think it might be vital to the next stage of energy development.
Well, if I may, in closing, I would just like to say that the utilities and the Alaska Power Authority have developed in the past few years, because of projects that have been built by the state, a very good working relationship, and we certainly feel that we can maintain that with the APA. I don't want to indicate to this committee that we don't have that with the APA, but I think that we need to have more people involved with it, more of the policy, more of the people who will make the actual decision as to whether or not this is a good project or these are a good set of projects, need to be involved in the step-by-step process.
You need to set a parameter up, suggestions up from your 25 years of activity that I know of. You've got that, you can draw on that breadth and depth of knowledge, and I think you need to give us some immediate suggestions in writing.
We'd be glad to, Senator.
Otherwise, there would be no statutory possibility this session.
Any other questions for Mr. Johnson? Mr. Johnson, thank you very much for
thank
coming
you.
Down this morning. Mr. Heath, the Director of Alaska Power Authority. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bob Heath, Executive Director of the Alaska Power Authority. I'm here to discuss 338 and answer any questions of the committee. I very recently testified on the House side, House Special Loans, on a very similar bill, but there's one very major difference I note between how the House is approaching this and how the Senate's approaching it. The House has set up a fund within the Department of Revenue called the Rail Belt Energy Fund by separate legislation. And the $200 million is being appropriated to that fund. And it becomes then totally appropriatable only by the legislature. And 338 appropriates back to the Power Development Fund. Those are the two differences between the approaches.
Mr. Heath, one reason I requested the committee that we not move the bill out today is so that the committee can look at that approach over the 5 days intervening between next Tuesday, and it might be the wish of this committee to propose an amendment to this bill doing a very similar activity. So it's one of the questions that the committee, having just heard about the House approach, would like to look at it and study it with a little bit more depth in the next 5 days. Senator Hopper?
Yeah, my staff will get copies of that so everybody can have one
right.
For the file.
Thank you.
And we did look at that. The problem was that we didn't have a bill with which to create the funds. So we would have been, if we'd moved legislation taking that approach, we'd have been making a deposit to a fund which was not created contingent upon the creation of the fund.
Sure. So we may have to have a finance bill introduced creating the fund. But it's up to the committee and something that we need to look at. Any other questions for Mr. Heath? Thank you, sir, very much. Larry Markley, Chugach Electric Association.
Morning, Madam Chair. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Larry Markley, and I'm Director of Government Environmental Affairs for Chugach Electric Association in Anchorage, a position I've held for 13 years. I'm here essentially to reiterate what Ken Johnson told you. Chugach is very much interested in the reservation of the funds that were previously earmarked for Susitna for the rail belt. We're very much interested and believe that there should be, like the idea of a working group, and we think it ought to reflect the utility policymakers as well as legislature, the administration. And we will be very happy and eager to work with members of this committee and others toward that. We, too, believe that, as Senator Petula asked Ken, that legislative action would be very useful in establishing such a working group.
Any questions for Mr. Marcos, Senator Petula?
Appreciate your testimony. CEA, and I've never taken a side in this. The CEA has had a different scenario often from the groups that buy power from you. I would hope that what happened to us in Washington, D.C. over an extensive period of years that gave you the right for generation for all the utilities in the area, I hope that doesn't become part of a scenario for politically grabbing this fund to retain CEA as the prime producer of power. I mean, I think there's got to be a fairness doctrine that accommodates the user groups in their interests. For instance, we have no redundancy or had none at all for quite a period of time because of the location of the generation in just Matanuska. But I know a lot of user groups are dissatisfied with the centralized responsibility that you now have, and that should be resolved. You shouldn't perpetuate your system, and it may be the cheapest and best thing we can do, I can't say that. But you shouldn't try to use this fund to perpetuate your position as GMT. I'm just saying this for the record. I mean, if it logically falls that that's the thing to do, great. It's the cheapest for all the public. I have no pride of where the location is and who runs it. But I think that that's a concern that I should exhibit. I once was the RECA representative to the legislature many, many years ago. I understand the politics of that group, and I understand the politics of CEA over the many years. Many good projects that were going to be generated in different areas were stopped by CEA's politics back in Washington, D.C. I don't want this to happen to this fund. If you're the best, and your organization is the cheapest and in the greatest public interest for producing juice, that's fine. So be it. But I don't want to see this become a mechanism or, in this particular case, a dictation of the imposition of the majority because we have the political strength in one area, in your area. I don't want to impose upon the rest of us that you're their G&T automatically, unless you are the cheapest and the best.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions for Mr. Markley? Senator Alford?
I agree with Senator Kutula's comments as far as the G&T. I think that's something that needs to get worked out, and it's been a real thorn in the whole rail belt for quite a while.
Any other comments? Thank you very much. Senate Bill 468 is in the Resources Committee. It would create a rail belt energy fund, so it's not necessary for the Finance Committee to generate a piece of legislation. Senator Halford tells me that the Resources Committee is going to take this bill up next week, so we'll have it before us when we decide what we're going to do with this.
Senate 454, Senator?
6468.
That's the number?
Senate Bill 468. Yes, sir, here it is.
Thank you.
We have another person to testify, Scott Holliman, the Alaska Environmental Lobby.
I want to shed a little light on this, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Heilman. I'm Executive Director of the Alaska Environmental Lobby, representing 20 conservation groups from around the state. Thank you for this opportunity to testify this morning on Senate Bill 338, reappropriating $200+ million.
Mr. Heilman, what is the purpose of the light?
I'm using it as an example a little later in my testimony, Madam Chair.
All right.
Thank you. The Environmental Lobby supports the changes in the committee substitute in Senate Bill 338 from an appropriation to the Susitna Hydroelectric Project to an appropriation for rail belt energy. I think this is a tacit recognition that the rail belt doesn't have a one-project solution. However, in general, the environmental lobby opposes the reappropriation of money. We feel this money is unnecessary and could be better spent on many other things. We believe there will be no great energy crisis in the rail belt, and I predict that demand for electricity will decrease in the rail belt over the 50-year period that we discuss so often with hydroelectric projects. This is not because of gloomy oil prices or a depression looming on the horizon, but because of an energy revolution happening around the country right now. Madam Chairman, there are two philosophies for energy strategies. Alaska is the first philosophy is the forecast and build philosophy. That's where we forecast electricity demand over the life of a project. We come up with upfront money to construct it. We charge a high fixed rate.
I'd like to go over that a little slower. My mind doesn't comprehend the very quick, fast.
I kind of wanted him to hurry up, but that's all right. Never mind. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. The forecast and build method, there's basically four steps to it. You forecast electricity demand over the life of a project. You determine how you're going to come up with the upfront money to construct the project. You charge a high fixed rate to cover the cost, and you hope that your prediction of sales will increase to cover the cost because you make a prediction. This is basically standard methodology, and that has been Alaska's philosophy to date, supply-side power production. In the case of Susitna, we've forecast a certain level of demand. We've discussed over the last few years how much state money it will be to construct it. We've determined a high fixed rate the utilities will have to charge, which will have to be offset by state subsidies. And you basically gamble that your sales will increase to cover that fixed cost. In the utility business, that's betting your company that your forecast is correct. With Susitna, that's betting a pool of state money. Madam Chair, another way to look at energy planning, which is becoming more popular around the country, is induced least cost energy planning. This kind of planning recognizes that electricity competes not just with fossil fuels, but also with efficiency technologies that are changing the ways we're looking at the world. For instance, some of those technologies include lights that produce the same amount of light but use 75 to 90% less electricity, appliances that perform the same function as appliances in your homes right now but use one-fifth the amount of electricity, buildings that, through efficient use of space heating, water heating, ventilation, and design, require no internal heating source, and industrial motor drives that the efficiencies of which have vastly improved. These are all technologies coming on the market every year. Investing in efficiencies versus the forecast and build theory has several advantages. First, it reduces the level of demand. Second, it reduces the uncertainty of the demand. Third, it reduces the gamble.
Mr. Holliman, could you keep your testimony on the bill, please, instead of giving us a lecture on ways to cut energy use?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to explain why we are opposed to the $200 million reappropriation. Fourth, it produces greater profits. Utilities around the country are buying efficiencies as an alternative to producing more electricity, and they're making money doing it. 50% of Americans right now can get efficiency loans or rebates from companies. Madam Chairman, the reason that we're not asking the state to use this $200 million, and we're not asking the state to invest in efficiencies, we're asking the state to stay out of it and let the market forces bring the utilities into the efficiency revolution. Because these efficiencies will come on the market. Around the country, utilities are marketing them in order to stay in business. Utilities that don't market them are going to build plants they won't be able to pay for eventually. I did bring the light bulb today as an example, Madam Chair, of one of those efficiencies. The light bulb right here produces 75 watts of light. It uses only 18 watts of energy. It produces the same amount of light that an incandescent standard 75-watt bulb does. It produces only 18 watts of energy. In effect, it's a 57-watt power plant. It lasts eight times as long as a standard bulb, and its wholesale price is $15. The savings in energy that a bulb like that gives us, if you assume that it burns 8 hours a day for 7 days a week, at that rate it would last 2.5 years. This bulb here would save 166 kilowatt hours a year. This light bulb also produces electric power and savings. It produces electric power and savings at the rate of 1.65 cents per kilowatt hour, which is roughly 12% of the per kilowatt hour charge that Wautana 1 has, and 21% of the price of Devil Canyon, which would come online about 8 cents per kilowatt hour. The savings in dollars of a bulb like this are also fairly striking. I came in this morning and counted the number of incandescent.
Could you save the
Senator Petula.
I'm still looking at that light. I've seen it long enough. I wonder if you could turn it off now.
Yes, ma'am.
So.
Thank you.
For instance, in this room, I counted 30 incandescent bulbs this morning, which would, if you replaced right now, if you bought these bulbs and replaced them right now, you would be saving the state $660 right now. They have those calculations if the committee's interested in it. The state of Arizona is buying these light bulbs for all their state office buildings at $9 a bulb, bulk rate. And a recent study by the state of Wisconsin found that they could save 3/5 of their electricity use through these kinds of efficiencies at less than 2 cents per kilowatt hour. In Alaska, these light bulbs are only one small example of the kind of efficiency technologies. For instance, this light bulb was not available 1 year ago. The kind of technologies that are coming online fast, refrigerators, appliances, and many other things. Briefly, for an example for the rail belt of what's just this particular efficiency technology could do. If you assumed 8 bulbs like this in each household at peak load, you could produce right now a residential savings of 61 megawatts right now. You could produce a commercial savings of 48 megawatts today. That's a total of 110 megawatts, which is 24% of Devil Canyon capacity, which wouldn't be available until the year 2000. It's more than a gas turbine, and it's a little bit less than the Diamond Shamrock proposed coal-fired plant at 150 megawatts. In conclusion, Madam Chairman, thank you for the patience, for your patience, and I hope that this committee will think seriously about these comments.
Senator Petula.
I have a couple of questions. Do you support power cost assistance, X millions right now, power cost assistance? Affects some of my district, but also affects much of the many other areas.
Madam Chair, power cost equalization program?
That's right.
We haven't taken an official stand on that program.
What is your stand?
In general, my philosophy is that that program is misguided in that it could be altered slightly to encourage savings rather than to encourage consumption.
Are you encouraging for the rail belt smokestacks and coal development of the Beluga area?
Madam Chairman, Senator Curtulo, we haven't looked at those proposals, but we have said in the past that a thermal mix as an alternative to Sitna makes sense. Coal may be a part of that, and we'll look at each project as they
Senator
present
Curtulo,
themselves.
Senator Curtulo, they only kill one project at a time. Any other questions? Senator Fisher?
I have a question. You represent some, 18 groups. Do you at all, among your groups, get out and try to encourage your own membership to use those kind of lights? If you have and you're that large, it seems to me we wouldn't have the crisis we have now that we need more power. Are you making any real effort to sell the general public on using those kind of lights?
That's correct.
Madam Chairman, Senator Fisher, for instance, this is a good example. This light's only been on market 1 year, so it's hard to keep on top of these things. We do talk to our membership. We also think that around the country, the pattern is that the utilities themselves market these kinds of things. So we are talking to the utilities, encouraging them to do that kind of thing here.
I guess my concern is, if we're really talking about saving energy, we have to turn the lights out. We could probably still, daylight might be enough to even see. But I wasn't impressed with the light, to be honest with you. When you turned it on, I said, God, they've got to put a little more juice to it, because it didn't do much for me. But again, maybe the shade's wrong or something. But I guess my real concern is, it's nice to come in. We're talking about an appropriation, as I see it here. And what I'm not saying, hear you saying, is you're opposed to the Bradley Lake development. You might be opposed to the power cost equalization fund. What's your solution for the energy that we're needing?
Madam Chairman, for the record, the environmental lobby has supported the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project. We're on record for that. And I wrote the position paper
it's
on 2 years ago.
It's more costly than Devil's Canyon for the production of electricity. That doesn't make sense if you compare, if you're basing your concerns on cost of power production.
One project at a time, Senator Curtulo. I told you, it's only one project at a time.
Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to provide, Senator Fisher, I'd be happy to provide you with a policy statement on energy prepared by environmental groups.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments? The only thing that gives me hope for the world is the environmentalists do not control the volcanoes yet.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Okay, we will move this bill hopefully on Tuesday. Get all your thinking caps on. Bring forth any amendments that you might have or any change of concept. And we will take it up again. Senate Bill 370. It's an act related to aid to families with dependent children and to child support enforcement. The bill is making the revisions to the state's child support enforcement statutes. We're very pleased this morning to have Holly Plug, who's the director of this division with the Department of Revenue, who's doing such a good job. Can we have quiet in the room, please?
you know the word for. She's a fake.
We are pleased this morning to have Holly Klug with the Division of Child Enforcement with the Department of Revenue to explain the bill, go over the sectionals, and answer any questions. Holly, good morning to you.
Somebody else, right?
Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Shall I proceed section by section?
Well, I give an overview, Holly, and then if they have specific questions, they're certainly not shy.
Okay. Last year, the legislature passed major legislation to put us in compliance with the new federal law that had been adopted in 1984. This bill primarily cleans up some of that bill last year because the federal regulations came out after we had passed our legislation. So we need to make a couple of amendments so that we are totally in compliance. And there are two other sections which are not related to federal compliance, but deal with the AFDC program and efficiency between AFDC and our operation in transferring information. We receive all AFDC clients come into Child Support Enforcement Division, and we attempt to collect child support to recover AFDC money that the state has spent on behalf of the children. And we have two provisions in this legislation which would improve that relationship and bring in additional funds to the state.
Yeah, for the information of the committee, Holly is one of the stars of the Department of Revenue. She's really doing a good job in coordinating the computer system and coordinating the information not only within the Department of Revenue but within the Department of Labor and the permanent fund dividend folks and all of that, and has really started an efficiency over there that I think will begin to show as the revenues go down, the efficiencies in collecting AFDC and getting child support payments to those children who need it. And Holly, I want to personally thank you for that work. It's very, very well done.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any questions from the committee about the bill? Senator Lyson.
Just a couple of general questions. Are your collections up now, at the present time?
Yes, they are, Senator. Our collections increased 12% in FY85, and of that 12%, we had a 20% increase on the AFDC side.
Has there been any reflection of the, the economy is not all that great out there now. Has there been a corresponding drop in participation in the program by those with child support?
What we've seen is an increase in the number of cases. That's the reaction. So our caseload has just gone sky high. We've got a 29% increase last year. And the paying, the voluntarily paying numbers have decreased, so that we need to take more enforcement action.
Thank you.
Senator, second, sir.
Is child support alimony?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and would you collect it in a case where you were not collecting child support enforcement? Would this provide you the authority to do that?
No, it would not.
Okay. Any other questions? Ms. Plug, thank you very much this morning. Do we have, if there are no more questions on the bill, can we have a motion?
Move out.
The bill has been moved with individual recommendations. Any objections? So moved. Thank you very much. Okay. Senate Bill 430. Senator Halpert, this bill is assigned to you, sir.
Okay. 430 is the Melody Point Royalty Adjustment.
I think it's quite good. Senator Sackett, you have no objections to
disturbing?
No,
I passed it.
Yeah, it's supposed to have been done. I put a note on it to do it.
Well, I can't use those in
the Senator Halpert, you may begin when you're ready.
So basically, the Melody Point unit went from 12.5% to 20% royalty when it was unitized. The economics of today indicate that that unit may not or probably won't be able to produce at that royalty economically. And the legislation allows for an adjustment of that royalty to reflect those economic conditions back to the original royalty. But the way it's drafted, it only applies to a royalty that was increased in a unitization agreement, and there is, I think there's one other lease, and the department can explain that, but it's very limited in its application, and as I understand it, it won't apply to anything but Milne Point.
I have a question to Senator Helfer.
Senator Katua.
Are you satisfied that neither the title nor the content of the bill opens the door to potential abuses beyond what you're seeking to do now or what the bill is seeking to do?
Well, I can't say that I'm totally satisfied that it can't be a precedent for anything. I do think that we should, by letter of intent, make it very specific that we intend this to deal with the economic conditions of today, and if the economic conditions change, then any adjustment should have an understanding of what those changes are.
Senator Hufford, I should have asked you this yesterday when you thought up the letter of intent. Would it be better to have it as legislative findings actually in the body of the bill rather than going as just a letter of intent?
I would be satisfied either way. I think what we should do is defer to the prime sponsor of the bill first and let her go through it and let the department go through it so we can get the background.
Senator Couture?
I have another question of Senator Helfert, and just goes to the point, but I understand Conoco is a modest-sized company, probably a subdivision of Dow or some major corporation. Does it have a substantial national production base, do you know?
I don't know that. We can ask them and their representatives here.
I'm just curious. That I think probably separate accounting would have a lot to do with solving the problem in this state if their investments are primarily here.
I don't know what their mix is.
Senator Lassen?
Madam Chair, the thrust of this memo, of course, addresses the decreased level of the wellhead. What happens if the things were turn around that we have the ability to get back in the situation we have now?
That's exactly what my concern with the letter of intent was, and I don't mind putting that in the legislation, in that any royalty adjustment down is price sensitive and comes back to the current figure if the price structure comes back to the $25, $30 oil.
Could I comment on that, too?
Certainly, Senator Katula.
Senator Helfert took me yesterday in discussion, and Beth and I asked the Director of Oil and Gas to come over and considerably, perhaps, and she can speak to herself, to her objection, or maybe not objection, but in any event, we told her what we wanted to do, and this is what we've decided to at least offer. It is the intent of the Senate's Finance Committee that the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall determine whether the public interest warrants reduction of a royalty obligation increase made in connection with the institution of a unit agreement. The Commissioner shall include in that decision a mechanism providing for adjustment of the royalty obligation should market conditions or the profitability of the lease's operations change in the future.
So, is this yours or yours?
I'm not sure whether Beth works with Senator Helfert on this.
Is it theirs? It's yours together?
I think it's more ours.
It's, I don't know, it's theirs.
So it's allowing for the decision of profitability to influence an increase later by the commission.
But I'm not sure that it's strong enough as it still reads. But I think we should ask the department, and I think we should ask the sponsor of the bill and start that way as we go through the bill rather than going around this direction.
Senator
Does, it appears to me that market conditions or profitability could further degenerate.
They're working on it, Senator. I just got the latest salary, yes.
So that doesn't really address if the profitability has increased.
But we're just speaking to the amount about 12.5% that we provided for. I mean, we're never talking about it.
Could you put some language in and say if the profitability increases, and we could look at it again? Does it say that?
That's something that should be covered.
Any other comments before we bring up the prime sponsor?
Give them a chance.
Senator Farrenkamp, now that we've totally discussed the bill, welcome.
Thank you. If I might respond to the discussion that I've heard previous to my coming up, and thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee for hearing the bill. It's my contention, and I have no problem at all with an amendment as long as that are up with a letter of intent, because it's my understanding that with the discretion of the commissionership, they can do that with or without the letter of intent. So that doesn't bother me. The thing that really bothers me is that this surcharge was inserted at the time of utilization, and at the time of utilization, prices were very, very high. And as all of you know, that's not the case today, and Milne Point and West Sachs are fields that I feel should be developed. Now, I want to bring to your attention that DNR and Conoco did work very hard to try to settle this, but it was the feeling of the commissioner that under the present statutory authority, they did not have the authority to go any further than they had gone now at dropping that surcharge. There was no way that they could have it continue if prices stay down. And knowing the actions of all of us are familiar with our other hearings on other areas and aspects of the actions of the commission concerning getting true value for oil or for gas, that our commissioner is not leaning towards giving anybody any undue breaks and certainly considers the welfare of the state as this is done. And I wanted to commend the department for their attempts. Their attempts were praiseworthy to work it out without having to have a legislation, but it was my understanding the legislation was necessary. Therefore, I put it in, and I think this is the solution. It gives the commissioner the authority. Our hands are no longer bound, but we all know that they'll be looking out for the best interest of the state. So all I can ask is your consideration and passage of it so we can develop these two marginal areas.
Appreciate talking to you on this legislation previously, Senator. It is my understanding that DNR and Conoco's local representatives did almost settle this. It was Houston that vetoed the settlement. So there was the commissioner and the Conoco had come to an agreement at this at the local level. And it was not her inability to settle, but it was in fact Houston that denied it, hoping to pass this legislation or take a different tack, a political tack, rather than the settlement with the commissioner.
Well, Senator, all I can tell you is what was said to me directly, and DNR said things speak for themselves. It's not my job to speak for any agency in the state. Just I have to tell you what I have learned. And
the commissioner said she was unable to settle, so she needed this legislation. Is that what you're telling me?
The commissioner said she had gone as far as she could go under the present statutes, and she needed legislative assistance if she were to go any further.
There was a settlement proposal that was accepted locally, I stand to be correct, but it is true, that would have provided for an extension of payment of the royalty ad infinitum if they continued the development, but would not make them pay the difference up front or in the near future, something of that order. And
well,
the locals agreed to it, and Houston turned it down and went to the political settlement. That's the information I got.
I'm just saying the people are here from the
companies.
So
all you have to do is ask them.
So
I don't know that.
Ask both of them.
I was not a part of the negotiation. Am not now. My only interest in this is that when we add a 7.5% onto our 12.5% at the time of that this was done, and it was when it was declared a unit, at the time it was done, oil was certainly where the field was something that could be worked at that level. Now it isn't, and it's just a decision, as far as I'm concerned, whether or not we want to give them a chance to develop a marginal field.
Yeah, just by way of background, and I think Kay Brown will go over this and do a lot better job of it, but Jay, that we're saying notwithstanding Jay, you can do this, the Jay portion says that in order to make a royalty reduction to make it economic, it has to have been in production for 2 years, and it hasn't been in production for 2 years, it doesn't meet that. It's apparently got two formations vertically separated, mm-hmm. and one of those formations probably will never be developed unless there is some change, and the other formation may be questionable as well. But I don't have a problem with them doing that. I do think we need to find mechanisms to make sure that should the administration change, should something else change, that this reduction doesn't become just a flat reduction and never go back, if in fact the price of oil goes to $40 a barrel. I don't know whether the best way to do that is with a letter of intent or in the legislation itself, but I think we should be making sure that that happens.
Madam Chairman, in response to that, I have no problem with that because I feel they have that now. I've been assured by them that they can do that now. So it doesn't bother me one way or the other. I just want us to help them.
Senator Sackett, did you have a comment, sir?
Yeah, why don't we get the department up here?
Well, as soon as we quit asking questions to Senator Fahrenkamp, we will. Do we want to spend any more time with Senator Fahrenkamp this morning? Thank you, Senator, very much. Okay, the long-awaited department, Kay Brown. Good morning, Kay.
Good morning.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, I'm Kay Brown, Director of the Division of Oil and Gas for the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. As has been stated here, the department did negotiate with Conoco after we reviewed confidential information that they submitted to us about their operations and their profitability and became persuaded that they had made a convincing case that they were not in a profitable situation. And we can come to this conclusion before the most recent price decline began in late January. We were not able to get an agreement with Conoco because our attorneys advised us that under the law we could change their obligation, but we could not reduce it. So along that line, we had proposed to substitute a 12.5% royalty and a 35% net profit share, as it would have changed it. The income to the state would have been the equivalent or greater over the life of the field, assuming that the shallow sands were eventually developed, but the income to the state would have been delayed. And when we were not able to get agreement on that, we decided to support the legislation to give us more discretion to try to resolve it. We do feel that a reduction or change is appropriate under the circumstances. So I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Senator Sackett?
Could you answer Halpert's question?
Do you remember Halpert's question?
Which question?
The question is there a method by which in the legislation itself we can require that any reduction made, which is the result of today's economic conditions, also have triggering mechanisms to provide for an increase back to the current royalty should the economic conditions go up?
I think the bill as it's written now would, we could do that, and I believe it is our intention to try to do something like that. I think if you want to have it absolutely nailed down, then you could put some of this language from the letter of intent into the statute.
You don't have any problem with doing that?
No, sir.
Basically, you're saying you can do that and you intend to do that.
Yes, sir.
I think we'd like to say that you're required to do that.
We would not object to that.
Mm-hmm. Senator Curtillo.
Did the scenario I ran off a minute ago, if you were listening to it, or 5 minutes ago, is that essentially the correct scenario in negotiations? That's the part about negotiating locally and having it turned around in Houston.
Yes, sir, although Al Hastings from Conoco is here, and he may want to further clarify. I assume that everyone who's negotiating for a group or a company is, you know, trying to get the best deal and then take it back to their management. If management does not approve it, you know, the person on point has made a good faith effort to resolve it, but I'm just not privy to what all went on inside that company.
Well, all right, I understand that, but it'd be fair to say that it was your opinion that it had been negotiated.
And
you were very optimistic of a settlement, and then something stopped it elsewhere.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Fisher.
Yes, thank you. Kay, in the fiscal note, says the bill would affect only Milne Point unit production. And yet the letter from the commissioner to Senator Jaluski said the bill primarily would affect the Milne. What's the other areas that might be affected?
There is one other existing lease in the Duck Island unit, the southern part of the unit. It's not under the Endicott Formation, but to the south, owned by Geopol, and they were the only other lease in addition to the Conoco and leases at Milne Point. But outside of that area, that agreed to accept a 20% royalty in 1979. So that lease has a drilling obligation, and if they don't drill in the very near future, the lease will expire. So there is no production on that lease now, and that's why I would estimate, you know, probably 99% of the impact of the spill would apply to Milne Point. And if there were a discovery on that other lease, which there has not yet been, then, you know, you could conceive that it might apply to that lease in the future.
Okay. Milne Point, when that was up for a lease, were there other people bidding on that particular lease?
Well, those leases were sold back in the 1960s, and I haven't really reviewed the history of who bid in those sales or which exact sales those were sold in.
I guess my question is, would other producers be a little grieved because of this situation, feeling that if they would have known or this possibility would have existed, that they would have been more interested in Milne Point, or don't you feel that's any...
I don't really think that's a concern in this situation, because at the time of the lease sale, the statute provided for a flat, fixed 12.5% royalty, so anyone else who bid in that would have been bidding on a 12.5% royalty, and it was later, subsequently, that Conoco agreed to have a higher royalty in return for extension of the leases.
Further questions to the department? Senator Petula?
Others let their leases go, which the state lease sold later at considerable profit. Is that not right?
Yes, sir.
Same. Thank you.
Senator Halpern?
I would just ask that you work with my staff and we'll figure out language to put in the bill. I'd like to do that.
It's my preference that it go in the bill. Okay, and I conferred with Senator Sackett and he agrees. So we would just like to have that language in.
Yes, I'll do
if
that.
That's all right. Senator Fahrenkamp?
As long that doesn't bother. But I'd just like to make sure that the way it's worded does not put us in a position where there would be open for lawsuits and their lawyers here.
So I don't think Ms. Brown's going to get us in a lawsuit. All right. Okay, listen, after what I did to the environmentalists, I'm trying to be nice. Okay, any more questions for Kay? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Tellengas, Conoco, and Al Hastings, do you both want to come up?
I thought you were awfully nice all day.
I have tried. It's almost beyond my capability as a human being to be gracious to this. It's test my Christianity, and I failed this morning. Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is John Tellinghast. I'm an attorney representing Conoco, and with me is Al Hastings from Government Affairs. I think at this point, we simply be here to answer any questions that you all might have, although I think Al might want to address the issue of whether there was ever a local settlement.
We want to know about the hanky-panky in Houston.
Okay. Al will tell you all about it.
Yeah. I'm Al Hastings with Conoco, and I'll answer Senator Curtula's remarks. We had been negotiating with DNR for, I guess we initiated this back in 83. It's always been DNR's position that they cannot reduce the royalty, they can only alter the royalty structure. When we had gotten to our final point, it was still only a royalty alteration. And basically what happened, reducing the royalty up front, it imposed a more substantial royalty on the shallow oil sands, which is the prospective zone that we wish to develop. And it would actually make it more difficult to develop the shallow oil sands because of the increased royalty burden on it than exists now. And that was the reason that it was unacceptable to Conoco. It would make future development more difficult rather than easier.
Senator Curtula, follow up.
Well, I understand there is an experimental stage of perhaps using North Slope gas or something to help thaw in a semi-frozen state or something up there in that particular sand. I'm sure they're going to have a lot of expenditure development. But the department did say they thought they had it in shape, and it was changed elsewhere. And I think that's a matter of record anyway, so I'm satisfied with it. Unless you argue that point.
There's no one in the Anchorage office that has the authority to make that decision. So that decision...
But did you have them there negotiating in any way?
Pardon?
Did you have the Anchorage office nevertheless negotiating for you?
Yes.
Further questions? Senator Fisher?
The original bill had indicated that Milne Point production would be 30,000 barrels per day. Now it's been revised in 86 to 18.5. Why the revision downwards? Because of the price of oil? Or...
There are a couple of reasons. There were several wells that were not drilled that were planned to be drilled because at the price of oil that we've got now, there's no justification to continue the development.
So if the price of oil goes up, then maybe concern Senator Halpern had, if the price of oil goes up, production probably will go up, and therefore would you have any objection to it being tied into the price somehow that the amount of revenue to the state would also go up per barrel?
Of course, if the production goes up, the revenue to the state goes up automatically because of the increased production.
But the rate wouldn't be the same as 12.5%.
Well, the decision to develop or not to develop, it's an economic decision. We have to foresee that we have ample opportunity to get a return on our investment and cover the risks associated with developing a zone that hasn't been developed before on the North Slope, and there's a certain amount of risk involved with that. There's techniques that will be required with that zone that have never been tried before up on the slope. So there has to be, for our company to continue, there has to be the potential to make a return on the investment.
Any other questions, comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've got further work to do on this bill. Hopefully, if Senator Halpern, you can work with the department and Senator Fatua and have a CS prepared for us by Tuesday, the committee would appreciate that. Our last bill for this morning is certainly not our least. Senator Kelly is here with us today, proposing amendments to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to the state treasurer. And Senator Kelly, you would approach the committee and tell the committee about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee.
Good morning, sir.
We have left the enabling legislation in the Judiciary Committee, unless there are 14 votes to pass this resolution out of the floor. If there are, the Judiciary Committee will then begin to work on the enabling legislation. So what we're talking about today is simply the constitutional amendment that would allow for the establishment of a joint, or rather of an independent state treasurer, independent of the legislative and executive branches. It's my belief that the executive branch has not lived up to its responsibilities of properly accounting for auditing state money. Frankly, even though I'm a member of the legislature, I think it's difficult for the legislature to, on a political basis, to audit an executive branch in a acceptable manner. And I think the solution lies in an independent elected treasurer who is responsible to the public every 4 years. And that's the concept behind the bill.
Questions for Senator Kelly? Senator Alaska.
I just had a couple, but I don't know enough about the Constitution as it relates to the qualifications of a governor or, as a matter of fact, probably the Attorney General. There's some suggestion that he be also an elected official. I assume that, not knowing that, the Attorney General would have to have some qualification before he could be elected. Obviously, we're not going to elect a fisherman to be Attorney General if you don't know anything about law. Is that assumption correct?
You mean the treasurer?
I'm talking about Attorney General.
Oh.
Does the Attorney General have to be a member of the bar? I'm not certain.
I believe by statute. The bill we had before us here, as it relates to electing Attorney General, that they have certain qualifications. And the question is, obviously, we're not going to elect the treasurer if they don't know anything about bookkeeping. I don't see that in here. Is that going to be an enabling legislation?
In the enabling legislation, it doesn't require that the treasurer himself have any background in accounting or auditing procedures, but it does establish a deputy treasurer that has to have 5 years' experience in public administration and auditing. And that person would, in fact, take the place of the treasurer if a vacancy occurs. But my guess is, you know, in California where they have, or other states where they elect a statewide superintendent of schools, normally the public won't elect somebody to a position like that unless they do have some background. So I would think how it would work in the real world would be that you would have to have some financial accountability in your background and your educational structure before you could probably get elected to the position.
Please, Chair, no, we're elected. I don't think you look to our qualifications that closely either.
You're right, Dick, but we're not running for state treasurer. I would think, in a relative manner, the person with the most experience is going to win an election in that case. That seems to be the way it works in other areas.
But another question, there are some certain qualifications, at least 5 years residence in the state. Are we going to have a problem with any of the residence requirements as it relates to that, or what are the qualifications for example, running for governor? You have to be in the state for 5 years. For the Senate, I don't think you have to be in the state 5 years to run for Senate.
You have to be in the state for 3 years to run for the legislature. Physically reside within the state for 3 years.
The governor's office, what about that?
I don't know, but you know, if we have to be here for three, so does he certainly. My guess is that I'd be guessing it's probably five.
There's a reason why
that's in there.
The question is, I'm just curious whether or not we're giving them additional qualifications as it relates to residence, which the governor is not required to have. If we were, if the governor was requirement would be at least 3 years, and the treasurer would be 5 years, what would be the rationale? Can you answer that?
Start stoning again.
I'd be happy to check on that.
We'll look into that.
Those are the types of things I'm curious about. Thank you.
Senator Petula.
Senator Kelly,
There are a few guidelines that seem to be fundamental to this office, and they came up during the discussion of the Attorney General's election, direct election. One is, would you oppose provisions such as was suggested in the Attorney General's legislation that for one full term subsequent to service he could run for no other office?
No, I wouldn't oppose that.
I think that would be a factor that would keep witch hunting down a little. Would you oppose... And it may be available under the Constitution, no, I don't know, but would you oppose a person that was distinctly out there using the office and abusing the public, and subsequently it was proved that he had systematically done this and over some period by a court decision and so on? Would you oppose the opportunity for the same impeachment provisions as the governor now has?
Absolutely not.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
There are two suggestions that we have for members.
Senator Elias, I'm sorry, Senator Fisher.
I'm assuming, even though it doesn't say here, that it is a partisan position, that they would have to file as a Democrat, Republican, et cetera,
It doesn't say that. In the enabling legislation, it does indicate that we elected at a general election, which puts you into the partisan process, yes.
Any other comments?
Just one, Madam Chair. I do know Section 29, where it refers to the budget of the state treasurer. Now, the question I have that is the way it looks today, that every agency in state government is going to be forced into some reduction. So the question that if, in fact, this department existed now, we wouldn't be able to reduce their budget?
The reason we have that provision in there so that neither the legislature nor the executive branch can hold the budget as a hammer over the head of a state treasurer that was doing their job.
Madam Chair, it seems to me that there's some reference here to the salary of this particular person could be reduced, providing it was sort of across the board cut. I think I read that here somewhere. Compensation, okay. General law applying to all salaries, okay. So this puts him in the same category as every other person drawing a salary.
It's paid at the level of the lieutenant governor.
Now, would you be opposed to some provision put in there also as it relates to his budget, as long as we cut everybody in state government?
No, I wouldn't be opposed to that.
Well, he should be cut also.
The idea is that the legislature can't use that as a weapon against an active treasurer.
Thank you.
Or the executive branch.
Further comments? Is it the wish of the committee to work with committee staff and prepare some amendments to this legislation? Senator Curtula, you had two suggestions?
Yes, I would move that we include as amendment for committee substitute the provision that a treasurer would not be eligible to run for one full term for any other political office, and two, that there be included an impeachment procedure essentially the same as that we now have for the governor violation.
May I request, sir, that you withdraw that motion right now, and we have committee staff look at a prepared...
Okay, I'll withdraw that.
Possibly for next Tuesday.
With both those items?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Sure,
are there any other? Senator Elias, you have some
suggestions. I think we should address the reduction in budget. I think that we'd be in a rather difficult situation if we reduced every department of state government and not be able to reduce them accordingly. So maybe some language should be put into the bill which says we can do that providing everyone else has had a reduction.
Any other suggestions?
And Madam Chair?
Go ahead.
Not that I'm trying to... No.
You're all right.
I'm curious about the qualifications rather relative to residency. If this exceeds any other state office, I think it probably should be comparable.
We'll look into that, but I don't think so.
Thank you.
I missed
the question I had was they're going to look into whether or not the 5-year residency exceeds other qualifications as would the governor's office. If it does, I assume you'd bring it back in line with.
Okay, any others? All righty, Senator Kelly, thank you very much. Oh, your staff then can work with mine and get a CS prepared for Tuesday. All righty. Just to recap, we'll have a CS for the committee to look at on Senate Joint Resolution number 12 on Tuesday. Senator Halpert is currently working on a CS for 430, an amendment for that. We have to, well, there's major policy questions now to consider on Senate Bill 338, the reappropriation money for Susitna, or whether we're going to put it in a rail belt fund. Please be thinking about that one. That's major. And gentlemen, if there's any way we can get the retirement bill out of here on Tuesday, it's not even mine, and I only have one little section in it, but I consider it a real favor to get this thing out of this committee, so if we could get our acts together on 253. And Senator Fisher, if you could keep me informed on the volcano, I have tell you, I won a science fair project in the fifth grade on a volcano project that actually erupted, so volcanoes have always fascinated me. Is there any other business to come before the committee?
I must have missed something.
You did.
Augustine erupted.